Welcome to episode 70 of the Vancouver Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Ogryzik, and we're here with our special guest,
Adam Dimitrik from AdaptTech Solutions.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Adam. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today.
Glad to be here.
We got a lot to talk about. I do want to mention something. I have a special promotion that's been ongoing for the past couple of weeks. A good friend of yours, I believe, Scott Belware, we actually met. You introduced him to me a few years back at ActiveState.
Yeah, a couple of years back. Scott has been very active in Agile and later in Ruby, so he's got about a couple of solid decades of experience in software.
And he's coming up from Texas to give a workshop at the end of April, April 29th and 30th. That's a Saturday and Sunday. And this is a Ruby microservices workshop. There's a lot of resources that he has available on GitHub as well through Eventide Project. I'll put a link down below.
Eventide Project on GitHub is the organization name, and the T is shared between the words event and tide. So Eventide-Project.
Our whole backend team is planning on going to this. We're not quite sure if Ruby is going to be the language that we'll go to. In fact, we're kind of leaning toward Go when it comes to breaking out microservices, but we do currently have a Rails monolith backend.
Yeah, we will be attending as well. We're sponsoring the event, so we're very happy as well that that this is happening in Vancouver and Scott's come up.
So is that going to be the whole AdaptTech crew?
Most of us. I don't think it's going to be all of us.
So we're actually giving away a free ticket through the Vancouver Tech Podcast. All you have to do in order to get a chance to win it is retweet. We have a tweet I'll put down below in the show notes. Make sure to look at that. Retweet that with at Vantech Podcast and be entered in a drawing. You have a pretty good chance of getting it. So anyway, what about this upcoming week? Is there anything in particular you're excited about?
Well, we are doing our regular meetup, but there is a special one on Thursday, Kubernetes one, which will be at 6 o'clock, I believe, at Hootsuite on Thursday. That's coming up. That's very interesting. And it coincides with ours. We use Kubernetes, and all of our event source stuff, our CQRS stuff, is deployed using that tool. So it's going to be pretty awesome to do that. I think what we may do is just start our meetup early to have a preamble to that. And then people that are also signed up to that can then go over there and make it like a 4-hour workshop of Kubernetes and microservices all into one fun evening of learning.
That actually sounds really awesome. I think the one you're talking about at Hootsuite is coming up the following week sometime on the 20th.
I thought it was this week.
But the one this week is also scalable real-time microservices with Kubernetes and gRPC. That's happening over at Unbounce, so a lot closer your DDD CQRS ES practitioners meetup
from
the Tribe. It's just down the street.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're at the Tribe, so that would be 3 blocks away. So it might be an interesting pre-party of CQRS.
You've done a really good job, I think, of promoting CQRS and event sourcing in the Vancouver area. What I'm kind of curious about is, and you may have seen it in the shared Van Devs channel, is sometimes people are a little worried that there's this technology, especially coming from somebody who preaches a lot about zero tech. There's somebody coming up and saying, we've got a technology looking for a problem to solve. When it comes to event sourcing, is that the case? Is this a technology looking for a problem to solve, or is it something different? Is it a methodology, an approach to solving problems? Is there a reason why that is a sort of golden hammer?
Yeah, it's sort of, it's really hard not to get pigeonholed into something these days when you're using acronyms and trying to label something. So it's none of the above, really. It's not a tool. It's not a framework. It's more of an approach and an understanding of architecture and just how data and behavior dance together when we make systems that are supposed to be maintainable, et cetera. It's about organization in the end. A lot of the stuff is just common sense. None of the stuff in CQRS and event sourcing is anything new, really. They are fundamental concepts that are as old as the 60s from computer programming. They're just arranged in a way that solidifies some of the priorities. For example, one of the tenets of that we follow and that you see immediately is that instead of building one system, always build two. And why is that? Simply, one of the problems that we've saw over developing software for many decades is most of the bugs come from the state transitions. So when the system becomes a different state, like someone updates their profile, someone orders a product, before a certain time, the system was one way, then it was another. So these are called state transitions, and they're sort of your your behaviors of the system. What we do is we treat that especially, make it its own system, because it's going to be a little bit easier to deal with it than having to shuffle through all the read operations as well. So essentially, we remove all the read operations, which would populate your screens or your give some information for queries through an API, put that in a separate system, call it, and it's usually a very traditional stack on that side. But the interesting part is taking all the state transition stuff out and making it its own write model. And that is the very, very core of the secret sauce of this approach, is that if you treat state transitions differently, it has an incredible amount of impact as to how you would scale that, how you'd maintain that, and how you keep it simple, and how you apply concepts like domain-driven design and all these other things. It's actually a lot easier in that area. So right from the get-go, developing two systems instead of one, we actually gain a lot of productivity and a lot of maintenance. So that's kind of at the core. So in a nutshell, it's not really a framework, because I can do this on paper, I can do this in Bash scripts, I can do this in Ruby, I can do this in C#, I can do it in any number of languages. So it has, you know, some people might say I have a preferred language for this. That's okay. It doesn't preclude you from adopting this on top of a very traditional stack like Java and an Oracle database. You know, some of the concepts underneath, such as the event streams, they simply can be a two or three column table where you put in the serialized events, and that's fine too. And a lot of migration paths from traditional type of development to event sourcing and CQRS are actually done like that, with no infrastructure change whatsoever.
So a few things I got from this were, one, it seems at least like you're saying that monitoring or caring about state and state transitions is not necessarily mutually exclusive of event sourcing or caring about events. So you may have both of those things happening. Another thing, you kept mentioning two systems from the get-go, and I'm imagining this is the CQRS component, where you're really separating one system for your writes, maybe publishing those events, and another system for your reads, your read models that may be updated when events happen.
That's right.
Potentially through some sort of PubSub. And I'm wondering if that is really essential in this setup. And then another one was, I forget now, so...
Yeah, so the PubSub part is kind of like, initially when people have read about CQRS and tried to learn all of this stuff, is what scared them, because it looked like you needed some sort of a PubSub mechanism, and that may have been an event bus or something, and which is associated with larger organizations. But honestly, the PubSub is very easy. It's a for loop in a single web request that just updates multiple things with that event that got emitted. Essentially, the transactional side and the analytical side, read versus write, both of these sides we're making one-way streets. So information comes in via the write side, and nothing can come out of that. All you can do is listen on the other end and subscribe to things that come out on the other end, update any read models, and then information comes up onto the screen through the other side. And that's a one-way direction. You can't, from the UI, you cannot update any of those screens directly. They have to go through the state transition part, the write part. So it's also called a circular architecture. And this gains a lot of simplicity, because when you're dealing with these one-way streets, it's sort of like Redux. If you read about Redux in React.js, it's adding, no bi-directional binding. There's definitely a one-way street for information. And it also gets its really good benefits from being making this PubSub model. Obviously, it's constrained to the DOM and the browser and all that. This is sort of similar, with a couple of key differences. We're not storing state snapshots. We're actually storing the events that are emitted and then projecting state. So there's some fundamental differences, but the one big similarity is the circular flow of data between both. So if you've read about Redux and in React.js, you actually see that in the documentation. It's mentioned at the bottom of this is inspired by CQRS, which, you know, Vancouver is a home to. You know, Greg, as you mentioned earlier, lived here, and for a year in 2008, we hashed a lot of this stuff out. Decided to really come up with a word, and I think it was called distributed domain-driven design at first, and CQRS kind of got coined here in Vancouver. So it was a lot of fun doing that. I was lucky enough to contribute to some of the scalability components of the write side mainly introducing works by Leslie Lamport from Microsoft Research. And that was obviously, if people have studied this, will be familiar with Paxos algorithms. And that's one of those things how you get consensus on that right side. As I said, the right side has an entirely different set of patterns for scalability. So that was my contribution to that. And I'm happy that I was able to help.
Very cool. So I guess another component to this is we've mentioned several times, you know, that or sometimes that this is somewhat, you can use your preferred language. It's more of an architectural decision. But then we also mentioned things like Redux following these sorts of patterns. So when is a good time, is a question, when is a good time to apply these patterns, I guess CQRS or event sourcing? Is there a time where you wouldn't want to? And does it then also sort of lead you into a set of tools? Can you be kind of system or tool agnostic, but still have a preferred set of tools because maybe they work better with this sort of way of solving problems? Is it always the best way to solve problems?
Yes, so you can stick to whatever you're doing, but there's certainly different languages. You know, some would argue that Scala AKKA is the ultimate CQRS language. I don't think it is. I don't particularly find that the advantages are really that outshine the overall approach. And I think it whenever you're very dogmatic about something, it's actually hurting your organization. And so I really do believe a lot in the polyglot way of working at an organization, being able to take advantage of a lot of different strengths of different technologies and approaches. And CQRS is something that allows you to do that. Mainly the PubSub part, really putting that in from the beginning, allows you to make read models in several different stacks, for example. So if you want to do some BI stuff, those events get, you know, published to that stack. And if you have someone that likes to use Elk stuff with Elasticsearch and all of these different things, then go for it. If there's some Ruby developers that want to do a traditional Ruby on Rails type of thing, well, you make a set of pages that they're after, that they're going to be looking after, and let them do their Ruby on Rails stuff with the one caveat that they're not going to do any updates of those models. They're going to have a separate channel to update the underlying tables. And then, the rest of the stuff's the same. So they can use whatever they're used to continue to author those pages. So it's a very good way of working because it doesn't get in your way when you really understand what it's about.
Okay, so would there be a time where you would say it's not the best tool for the job?
I've been trying to say that. So, let's go back to 2008. And obviously, that was one of those cautious things that Greg himself actually said. It's like, well, you know, this is really good for fintech because event sourcing itself is, you know, the recording of all these events. And it's very accounting-like. It's a bookkeeping dual entry type of endeavor of only growing data. You can't change anything. You just can add compensating transactions after or compensating events after. You know, someone made a mistake, put in the wrong name in the name field. They don't get to edit that event. They have to add another name changed event, you know, for example. So a lot of this on the surface looks like, hey, this is all like fintech. This is great for banks and whatever. And that is true. At the same time, when we were cautious about this, we're saying, well, okay, it's not for everything. It's overkill. And I've been trying to find the domains and the verticals where this doesn't apply. And I've been just coming up empty handed. And the more and more that I try to find domains and verticals where this doesn't apply, the fewer and fewer places I see. So I've been doing this by default, and it's only grown in terms of applicable scope. As we've proved out a lot of the patterns and the initial concerns that we had. So if you have something, I mean, obviously there's niches like that may not use any of these concepts at all, like cryptography is entirely, you know, mathematical or whatever. But there's other ones that have kind of become hand in glove. For example, additive only systems, you know, you see a lot of that in blockchain and all of these things. So it's perfect for that. In fact, one of the open source projects that we're doing is Noda, none of the above, which is a referendum type of system where you can put up something for a vote, but if you don't like it, the system automatically adds a none of the above choice at the bottom. So you don't get, you know, as a voter, you don't get forced to make a vote for something, you know, you don't like. You can always make your voice heard that you just don't even like the choices. So that's going to be stored on top of, you know, blockchain technology and all that. And so event streams are very good for that. So anything like machine learning and AI also is very, very good for CQRS and events, especially event sourcing. So we're seeing more and more interest from those areas as well. So it's only grown, which is great.
I was going to say something like a website built from entirely static web pages in just HTML where you have some links to click. And then I thought, you know, each of those clicks and each of those hotspots may be published as an event, and you may want a separate read model to actually gather analytics over where users, what users are doing. So maybe perhaps even in that case.
Yeah. And so traditional ways of developing software have always focused on the data structure and less so on the behavior. And inevitably what happens is behavior sneaks into the system as requirements are refined. So it's just easier to start with something that has that in there. And if you catch it early enough, you can move whatever static structures you have into the read sides and start adopting the write side model a little bit more naturally. So that's the old sort of inflection point of when you start to introduce responsible development and instead of cowboy coding your MVP. So one of the best things about event sourcing and CQRS is that you don't get trapped into the MVP, and it actually gets rid of some of these core problems of moving from one version of software to another, and mitigates things like data migrations, because they still happen. They just happen very organically as you move the events from one version to another.
So what about in maybe a more realistic sort of approach where you already have a system, you have a legacy system that's not event sourced, you haven't been following domain-driven design, so you've got sort of different sets of vocabulary depending on who you're talking to. You've got the lexicon of business, you've got the lexicon of developers, and maybe a couple of others, you know, marketing and whatever. In every conversation, you're trying to translate. You almost need to bring a translator to be able to say, you know, this is a sign up. Oh no, you mean a log on. Or logged in or signed in, or you know how that's working, even with something very similar. And you have so where do you go from there if you want to have this sort of legacy system and now adopt?
Well, that's a very, very big topic, and obviously I've been a big proponent and student of Michael Feather's works for working effectively with legacy code. It's a very particular book because it concentrates on refactoring the code to be better understood, as you're saying, to use the proper terms so that it's understandable. At the same time, it's a tremendous amount of effort. And I think the answer is really in the middle, where you have to keep the legacy code alive for a significant amount of time because it's giving you value. So we call it a legacy investment. And what we do is we start to source events from it, not event sourcing, but source events from it, meaning we make the legacy system chat about what it's doing. It starts to publish events, and we don't want to be to really have this necessity to touch the old code base, because it may be brittle, and it's in fact something you don't want to touch because of the risk profile there. So, you know, things like triggers on tables may be a very empirical way of sourcing these things, where you look at every single table that a legacy system is affecting and put triggers in there to publish any updates and inserts, etc., deletes that you may have, and publish that into a stream where then you can start to make use of this and build any compensating actions. Let's say there's a bug fix that you need. It may be just it's one of these things where you pull the thread on one end of the system and everything else breaks on the other end, which is the traditional problem with legacy stacks. To get away from that, you kind of want to move to compensating actions and put in the secondary system that will listen to what's going on and see the error cases and then make a compensating action for it. So we definitely want to improve the legacy system, but we don't want to be forced to make all changes in the legacy system. So by doing an event sourcing system on a sort event source system on the outside and feeding it information for lookups and other data by making the traditional old school way of doing things talk and publish these things, that gives another avenue where you can still have the investment, the legacy code, and you have the people that have that 10-year experience with that stack and can fix some things, but you're not limited to that. You can move new developers to work in the new systems and maybe even an entirely new stack for all intents and purposes, and maybe adjust that column in the table to fix the error instead of having to swim through the legacy code.
So what are some strategies that you might put in place to ensure quality of events, that you're getting the right data in your events? And would you ever change the types of data that events store?
Absolutely. So two ways, just to finish off the legacy stuff, the events that you get from the legacy code will be very cruddy, very ugly, and you probably want to put that through a translation layer so that when you're inserting something into a scary looking table and the names don't make sense, you ask the people that that know what that is, and then you translate it into something that fits the business today, and you use those events instead. So there's definitely an anti-corruption layer there if you follow the domain-driven design terminology, that you translate that over. For new systems,
would you keep publishing the old style of event and just now have two different events?
Yes, because you would want to use the mapping of what that old ugly looking event is, and you want that codified to say that, hey, I know that this cryptic looking column name and whatever information's in there that's kind of hard to read is translated to something that makes sense to the business today, right? And that will give you that agility to fix things and think about things properly. Now, for new systems, yes, you do make the mistakes as well of naming things wrong, or maybe you forgot to ask for the credit card when you made the sign-up event and the system's live already. So event versioning is a huge topic because that's how you move forward with event source systems. Greg Young is almost finished the event versioning book, so that's available on LeanPub, and we'll provide a link to that. So that's one of those things that that's kind of been a question for a lot of people of how you do it. A lot of the people that have been doing CQRS and event sourcing for a long time, they kind of gloss over it, and they've learned it organically through going through these systems. But for someone that wants to really learn in a short time everything there is to learn, the book is an excellent jumpstart for versioning and event source systems. And it's available on LeanPub, and go ahead and get it. So that would help out with that.
Yeah, it's got a minimum pay of only $4.99.
Oh, yeah. It's a bargain.
And it goes up from there. So that definitely looks like it'll be worth a read for me. Okay, so that sounds pretty interesting, and I think you've sold me on a lot of the concepts. Obviously, I'm going to have to get my hands dirty with it and play around. And I think you've mentioned that the DDD CQRS ES Practitioners Meetup that happens every Thursday. What is it, from 4:30 to 6:30?
Yeah, we allow people to come in earlier if they have other questions, but we try to start at 5. I do an introduction from anywhere from 15 minutes to half an hour for those that are new, to basically go over what I told here, which it's a little bit easier to explain with a whiteboard. So I do a lot of this explanation with some diagrams that make it a little bit clearer. Although the last meetup, there was so many questions and so many interesting things to talk about that my 15 minutes went on to become 1 hour and a half. So we usually
sounds
don't do that.
But do.
I wish it was recorded because my throat was pretty dry after that.
Well, I remember a while back I was working on an API and kind of getting the time to talk with people in my company, just setting aside an hour or whatever to do a design session, was really difficult because everyone was busy. We were all working on our own things. And I ended up going to one of the DDD CQRS ES practitioners meetups and saying, hey, I've got this thing. Let's do an event storming session. And we did that. And even though it was actually my first time, I think, ever even doing that, I was able to leave with that, with some post-it notes that were the events that I would care about, and actually build out 90% of the API of the requirements that I wanted to have the next day, and then consequently kind of filled that in and in a very solid way that hasn't really needed any change over the past year.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that this is definitely a topic that we could talk about over an entire workshop, entire day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to condense everything into this podcast. But one of the core things about, hey, is this too complicated to start with? It absolutely isn't. And this is why we start with that. And as you said, when you're gathering requirements, the traditional way of doing wireframes and maybe doing some use cases, it seems to be very disconnected. So what we do, the fourth thing, beside the three first acronyms, the fourth one that we actually start with a lot of our projects is is event storming. And as the name suggests, it's kind of like brainstorming. And what the idea is that you get everyone in the organization, at least a representative from each department, all the way up to the CEO, of course, depending on the company.
And all the way down to the janitor?
Absolutely. Well, code janitor, sure. But yeah, you know, you want to have as wide an audience that's capturing, you know, all the people that have interest and have to deal with the system that you're going to build. And in that brainstorming slash event storming session, what happens is you pretend the system has been built already. And then what would happen if you open up the hood and look inside and see what events have been stored, what facts are evident in the system? So you can get events like user signed up. And then what are the properties of that event? You know, there's a username, there's maybe a hash of a salted password or something like that. So you have a lot of interesting information from that. You can see on a timeline with sticky notes as to what the system's supposed to do. And everyone that's involved, the secret is that you have people that are coming in from different angles of the organization to argue about whether something is correct. The traditional example that I give is you can have the CEO argue with the customer service rep about whether the credit card is needed on the sign-up event, right? What a great time to have that discussion with everyone there and present than 6 months down the line when the system's live. So this is sort of why I call this also the agile architecture. Agile kind of threw away all planning and all that kind of stuff. This is the responsible level of design up front, because it takes so little time. This workshop usually lasts an afternoon, maybe a day, depending on your scope. Really large scopes, maybe a couple of days, or it may have to be broken out even further. But what you're providing is a forum for getting consensus on language, what the system looks like, and most importantly, what does success look like? What is your done is done point? You know, you basically know that once these events are stored, that you have fulfilled a part of the system. And that's very hard to argue about. With the traditional way, there's always some hand waving and some opinions in there. But with this way, it's very black and white as to this is finished because these events exist in the system. And it also does carve out, four quadrants of value and risk. So you know that the most important things, the state transitions are done correctly. Maybe there's some reports that have data that's kind of looking a little bit iffy, but that is certainly not going to stop the system from failing. So ability to put people of different abilities onto different parts of the system where there's a natural fit, and to have a place to put your juniors or your interns on to give them the confidence, not about mitigating your risk, but actually to have the benefit of giving them the confidence they need in true sort of agile principles. Develop with confidence, right? And so a lot of this pub-sub stuff at the beginning is a turnkey way of doing that. You know, you can have a bunch of people work on similar pages or have a fun competition of who can write this report better. They do is subscribe to the same event stream and see who wins. That's a fun hackathon thing to do, for example.
So it sounds great. I think when an explanation comes from the point of view of somebody who understands a topic quite well, but then there's also the assumption that other people are on the same mental page as you when you're thinking about, you know, here's what DDD is, here's what CQRS is, here's what ES means. And if you already understand that and you're saying, here's why you would use it and justifying it, that's great. But what about for the people who aren't on that page and don't see that and don't see any benefit to it because they're maybe not understanding some of the words or some of the acronyms and they just sound like buzzwords? That's one part of this question. Another is we often hear DDD, CQRS, and ES together. And I just wonder, is that something that necessarily has to be the case? Is the event storming, for example, an essential part of the domain-driven design and even just having that sort of ubiquitous language there? Then another thing is, if we have these big sort of event storming sessions up front and we start designing our systems around this, are we then locked to these terms? What if we want to change? Is that difficult? Is it any more or less difficult than in traditional systems? And further, how hard is that line drawn or whatever?
Yeah, so obviously you're not going to get everything specified right up front, but it does give you something to start with and actually build something very quickly. It could be a couple of days. One example is we went to one of our clients last year and did an event storming session for about, I guess, half a day. And myself and Nicola, one of our top guys, we went away for a couple of days and coded up essentially the core of the system for by Wednesday, right? The CEO was just blown away that this wasn't any kind of framework type of development where you filled in some framework business logic places. This was built with the intention and the code, on the, at least on the transactional side, that if you didn't change the requirements, that code was good enough to go and service, you know, 50 million users. They're quite impressed that production-ready code was ready within 2 days. I haven't seen many places that can give you that approach and circumvent what traditionally in startups is an MVP requirement to go ahead and just do version one right away. The reason that you don't have to get everything right is that, again, going back to the event versioning, you can keep repeating this exercise as new information comes into play. In fact, a lot of these event storming things with a big white roll of paper and a ton of little stickies on it is rolled up or folded up, put in the corner. But when new information comes to light, another short session, maybe a lunch break or maybe an hour meeting, it gets rolled out again and the new event is introduced and those stickies are moved. Now, one of the reasons that you can move from those stickies and that timeline put on sticky notes really quickly to implementation is that you can carve out given when-thens in the behavioral-driven development style, given some set of events that happened before. When I try to do this command, then I get this event, right? That's it'd very be black very and nice. White. So now, let me just finish the point, because sure. What's awesome is that you think that that would have to be translated to some documents, but all we did was took pictures with our phones. And so you could go through, you know, 20 use cases very quickly and have something that is good enough to build a system that does what the organization wants to do. Yeah.
It'd be very nice to see some sort of video tutorials on this. Does AdaptTech have a YouTube channel?
Yes, we have a YouTube channel, and so we'll have that in the show notes. We have a couple of interesting things there. You know, lots of things have happened with AdaptTech over the last year, so there's a lot of interesting videos. One of them is, of course, one of the event storming sessions that you attended, one of the first meetups that we had. So you can see how that works. Also, the person that came up with the concept of event storming, Alberto Brandolini, is one of our advisors. He's from Italy. We are sort of international now, and he was very happy to join us and as an advisory role and in a partnership. So he's also available. I mean, if there's a really large, I know of a couple of companies, at least personally, that I'm involved with that are moving their entire really large established organizations to DDD and CKRS and event sourcing, and that is their platform, their preferred way of building their new platforms. So that's really exciting to see that it's happening in Vancouver and you know, all the way down to individual startups, which is just fantastic. And I'm very happy to be able to unite a global community of people that have written some of the books on the subject right here to Vancouver. And then, of course, again, as I said, people from all over the world looking at Vancouver for the place where they want to get their new systems that are going to start off on the right foot. They are coming to Vancouver. So that really puts us on the map. In fact, Scott Belware says that Vancouver puts to shame a lot of the places that he's going to around and doing this workshop in terms of how many awesome technical people here exist here. The fact that CKRS comes from Vancouver is pretty awesome too. So yeah, a lot of good stuff around this approach.
Another thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was, it seems you've had some really great success with working with people at all different levels. And I mean, developers, you know, you have some very senior developers who have a very solid understanding of CQRS, of event sourcing, of DDD. And you also are, it seems at least, you're able to onboard juniors straight out of boot camps and get them up and running fairly quickly.
Oh, absolutely. We had Paul from, I believe, CodeCore join us very early on. Has been absolutely fantastic. Others came in from the university track. There's Emily. She's I think suspended her PhD efforts. She's got a master's. She's absolutely a brilliant mind. This is her first job, and she's just tearing it up. Understands this. One of the best things about having new people is they don't bring in really bad habits, which is so awesome for this, because they understand from the get-go the difference between state transitions and query logic. Right, that core OO concept that tried to be, you know, CQS, how it evolved into an architectural concern. It's awesome to see these people go and surpass what some of the traditional people would be labeled as, you know, senior and expert.
I spent some time traveling overseas through Asia, actually a number of years, and time here as well, and some time also teaching. And something that I found was some people have spent a lot of time learning things. I remember meeting one person. He was from Korea, and during his military service in Korea, he'd memorized an English dictionary. And after he'd memorized every word on a page, he'd eat that page. It's just kind of, a psychological thing.
Is he still alive?
Yes, I think so. We haven't kept in touch, but so he knew every word that you could really think of.
He was hiding a really bad habit.
But he could not form a single sentence.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember trying to work with him over the course of a couple of months, and he ended up just giving up, realizing that, you know, he'd remembered all these things, but the wrong way, and he'd had the kind of the wrong patterns. And to break those habits after putting so much effort into it was kind of heartbreaking, I guess, for him, and something he just didn't want to go through. And I also remember working with some people who maybe they weren't the best students in school and hadn't really put any effort into studying English, came over here to kind of have fun and got a good system for learning. And within 3 to 6 months, went from raw beginner to advanced, and I would say almost fluent.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about how the mind works and how sometimes relaxing the mental rules that people put around learning is good. I had the similar experience with French. I grew up in Vancouver, so you take French as a second language. And only until well after university and, you know, into my late 20s did I reconnect with a French-speaking community. And I noticed that when I was in a much more lively, easy kind of setting with maybe a couple of beers, my French would be amazing.
Yeah.
Outside of that, it was tedious, and I felt too shy to talk.
Very true.
And exercise French, but I mean, I could have a conversation in a different setting, and another I couldn't.
So do you find the same to be true with programming?
Yeah, absolutely. The same thing happens with, especially, you know, imposter syndrome, and people are afraid to show the level of their knowledge or something like that. So, you know, that's not an absolute answer. There is some sense that, yeah, you can't just let in anyone and let them, you know, go in and say that they're going to be the best programmer and they're not. But at the same time, you want to allow people to have that freedom to express where they're good at and take advantage of what their interests are. So that's one of our core strengths, actually, is that we don't really have an assigned job per person that's working on a project. And so people have gone from working on the state transitions, those awesome given when thens, those pure function type, you know, pure functional code, and back and forth between the read models, which are more traditional type of development, you know, a lot of HTML there and CSS, etc. But it's really nice to be able to shift that and allow people to move to the area that they want to work in at their comfort level, or maybe they just want to change, or maybe they want to learn something. And I'm happy that we can provide that very seamlessly, where it's not as easy in other organizations that I've been part of.
Something this reminds me of, and maybe take note for how often you hear this in your day to day, is people often say at so-and-so company, we did it this way, or we did it that way. And for me, that's a smell or a tell, yeah, or that raises a red flag to me, as in, if anybody prefaces something with, here, I did this way, I'm thinking you have a tool, or you have a method or a pattern that you've done successfully one place, and now you think you recognize that and you want to apply the same thing, mm-hmm, without necessarily looking at this problem and looking at the breadth of solutions that you could apply to it. And I'm very hesitant to accept that as a viable choice.
Yeah, it's again, there's two extremes to those things. If you don't do any of that, then you lack some technical guidance and vision, and people end up going into multiple places. You may need to then have management to take the people that are less experienced and ensure that they have some sort of cohesion to their efforts. So there's a right answer somewhere in the middle always. And for us, that's, we have some core principles, mm-hmm, with CKRS. We definitely throw away the don't repeat yourself principles, particularly on the read side, where we actually encourage copy paste and boilerplate code for some of the stuff, because there is stability and risk management and repeatability, as long as it's done with the right architectural principles in place. There's absolutely no problem with that. So I think that you need very strong technical leadership so that people know where they're going and they can get behind it, and that's what gives them the confidence. At the same time, you don't want to be dogmatic about the details and unimportant things, right? So for us, we were very clear about, you know, events being the primary source of truth. It's how we design systems. We have some recommendations for certain things, like, you know, it should be tech agnostic at all times. We don't want to have our developers' preferences lock our clients into a specific stack. So a lot of the effort that we do is really something that not what other consulting companies do, is we want to not ingrain ourselves that the companies need us. We want to teach and show this approach to our clients. And if they're happy and they're off on their own doing this, that's great. Then we have an excellent testimonial and say, hey, Adaptic came here. We learned event sourcing from them. We did CQRS, and we now do it ourselves thanks to them. That's way better than any amount of money in the bank account to me anyway.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the other things that you're doing, some of the other meetups. You have the DDD CQRS ES practitioners every Thursday. What else? I heard there's a resurgence of the Linux desktop meetup.
Yeah, so last year I was just doing way too many things trying to really get things going for Adaptic, and that meant a lot of community work. But I had three meetups a week that I was heading up, and I didn't have any co-hosts or people that could take over for me. So that, and on top of that, running an entire business. So I was working in very, very long hours, and I decided to drop two of them for temporarily suspend them. And luckily, I had Robert and others being able to pick up the CKRS one, which is every week. And there's a lot of people coming up every week. So it's important that that one kept going. And now I'm back, and it's a little bit, I had a time to reset. So some of these things, such as the Linux desktop meetup, is I started again. I've had one this week where a couple of people came back, which is great. And I'm looking for a co-host for that, because I don't want to put myself as a bottleneck, right? My initial effort was to, like, hey, no one's doing this. Someone's got to do it, so I'll do it. And then people were like, well, you did it, but now you're not there, and, like, we're upset. I'm like, well, come out and help me. I don't have so many hours, right? Hey, you know, where were you when there was...
So you're looking for, yeah. I'm looking for people to help,
yeah, absolutely,
with the Linux...
The Linux desktop one would be great.
What are you looking for specifically?
Just someone to actually be there and have a little bit of Linux desktop background. So it could be KDE, could be just regular Ubuntu. It doesn't matter what it is, especially laptop help, because that's sort of the last frontier for a lot of Linux installations is the laptop. Although it's become incredibly awesome, my new Dell XPS 13 came with Linux installed for $100 discount, which is awesome. Big plug to those guys and other companies like System 76, and there's a whole slew of them that actually are doing this, which is amazing. Just was not heard even, you couldn't even think about this 10 years ago, which is awesome. So yeah, for people that are taking that that approach to a dev machine that actually has Docker running natively with you know, with no Docker machine needed on there, that's awesome, right? Mm-hmm. So that was actually a use of machine twice there. So yeah, you basically, all you need to do is know a little bit about Linux, maybe have Linux installed on your laptop if you want to help out. Come on out to the tribe, and I think I'm going to put that on the same nights as I did before. It was Wednesday, started at 4, maybe we'll do a little bit later, but 4 to 6, that allows people to go to other meetups again. And then the other one was Git and Git and Zero Tech, which was on Mondays. People have been asking about it. So again, I need a co-host. So someone that knows Git really well, generally will probably also know some of the low-level bash scripting and using JavaScript with no framework and other things like that, which is kind of the incentive there to see and measure what frameworks give you by looking at what the effort is without a framework, right? One of those, I just had a discussion with someone the other day about what that means and why is it important. For example, the difference, why am I using Angular versus React or the other way? You do these pros and cons lists between the two, but rarely does someone look at how would you do this with no framework. And I liken that as a similarity to having two-way merges in old subversion land, where you have your version and the version you're trying to merge, and you just have those two viewpoints. With Git, you get the base model. So when you do a three-way merge, you get to see your version, the version you're trying to merge, and also as a reference, where the common point for both of your versions were, right? So zero tech is kind of like this resetting of looking with a better perspective on what you're adopting. Because a lot of these frameworks and tooling and libraries, that increases your total cost of ownership. Even though it's not your code, every line of code has a chance of having a bug in it. So the more, you know, code you own, whether it's in your internal process or the code you're actually going to ship to your clients, you own all that, and that has risks. So, you know, reducing the total cost of ownership is really the motivation behind the zero tech approach, and being able to see that, hey, I don't need Jenkins and I don't need Jira. I can use branches for my organization to act as Jira does for others, right? I can use a bash script, a one-liner for my build. I don't need an entire Jenkins thing. And here's a way to organically grow that with fundamental regular programming principles, so it doesn't become a messy kludge. Treat it as, you know, good code and all that. So that's going to be part of my book that hopefully will come out at the end of this year as I get better with my time management. So it'll be probably around four sections, looking at tooling from what runs in production to also instrumentation and continuous integration and continuous delivery, issue tracking, Kanban board replacements, projections from code onto something like a non-technical person could use. So we've even used Netcat as a web server to say, yeah, you can do this straight from a repo even for a non-technical person. So
very cool. And will that be available on LeanPub?
Probably. I'm not sure. I might try a different model. LeanPub is great though, so we'll see. I definitely want to have a little bit more of the code examples, at least. There's going to be two sections to each of those chapters. One that's going to be business focused, and the other that's going to be a look from the technical side. Because I think it's important to always have both of those sides addressed, and so that the CTOs out there that make a recommendation, they're looking at a book like this that addresses both sides. And of course, comes from the whole CKRS event sourcing thing, where we really marry the two sides anyway for how we solve problems. So that's one of the biggest lessons I learned in the last 8 years, is how important the focus on business is when you're implementing solutions. And that doesn't go, that's still the same for the zero tech stuff.
You took a pretty large risk, I think, when you decided to start your own business. A year or so now later, what do you think? Was that successful? Was it a good risk to take? Would you recommend people doing that? And how would you go about it differently if you were to do it again?
I wouldn't do anything differently. I think I've learned a lot from making a lot of mistakes and having a lot of successes both. So I think there is definitely a level of experience that one can get one of two ways, being a regular employee and learning from what they see. Then probably a harder approach is when you don't have enough experience to go off on your own and learn things a different way. But it's not impossible, and lots of people have done it. I think for myself, I have no regrets at all as to how this has gone. And so I would highly recommend people that are not satisfied with where they're working and that they have a problem being an employee. I certainly did, and a lot of people that we have are not. They just don't fit the mold of someone that you would really even want in your organization at a certain point in time, because they just think differently. It doesn't fit a traditional shop anymore. So instead of getting frustrated with trying to convince, you know, your CTO and your manager that event sourcing is great, the old mantra was, well, go change jobs if you don't like it. Well, it seems that a lot of people, they run out of places to go. And maybe there's just the way they're thinking doesn't really give them many choices of organizations of where they could go. And maybe if there was a good organization, maybe the cultural fit's not there. So again, not a good place for them to go. So for many of those, start your own consultancy and all that. And we're doing a lot of partnerships now as well with different places. So part of our goal for this year is to get to the point where we're trying to do a lot better for Canadians and people in Vancouver specifically is being able to bid on government contracts and do things in this really nice, efficient way so that your tax dollars go further. I think also by just giving away this way of working and showing how Adaptech works as a consultancy, we'll make sure that it raises the bar for everyone as well. And then it just permeates the industry. And eventually we'll have everyone coding like this, and we'll have a more efficient government too, and have smaller classroom sizes and all those other things that we want. But it's all about making sure that everyone's as effective as possible. Right now we're at a place in the whole market where not enough people know about event sourcing, for example, that we're quite happy that there's competitors to us. We love that because it's, as my colleague Robert always says, the tide raises all boats at this point, right? So we're very happy to see other companies do event sourcing. It just means that there's more future customers. We're definitely on, you know, the very start of all of this, but in 2 years, it's going to be quite common. So I think we're at the right place to really, you know, ramp things up, which is great.
So just we're kind of running out of time here, Adam. So just to wrap things up, there are still quite a few questions that I have for you. But
I'll try and get through them very quickly.
So some things, I guess we'll start with this. Is Adaptech hiring?
We always are, but we're very non-traditional. So I haven't really had real interviews because we have a shared space. We can code with people. And again, we're mostly doing things on contract. So it depends on how much work there is. But work is always coming in right now. So yes, we're always working. And we're always looking for people. We don't have exact start dates. So, but some of the best hires, I mean, right now we hired a guy, Quinn, who's an awesome guy that Drew and I worked with. He's basically implemented an entire communication platform and got funding and quit after 2.5 months of working with me. So he's come in as an advisor for cryptography, blockchain, and all this stuff. One of the foremost awesome people that can actually not just understand the concepts, but implement them in a record amount of time. He's an awesome guy to work with. He's doing a lot of our Kubernetes stuff right now as well. So that automation was done by his hand within a day. It's just amazing to see this guy work. So yeah, we're always hiring, and when there's an opportunity for juniors and guys like Quinn, and more importantly, the juniors get to work and see how guys like Quinn work and how their mind works, because there's some of the most amazing people if you get a chance to work with them.
Very cool. So other than the obvious Linux desktop meeting, again, potentially upcoming Zero Tech GitHub meetup, and DDD, CQRS, and ES practitioners meetups, what other meetups might we catch you at if somebody wanted to reach out, or where would be a good channel?
So I'm on Twitter a lot of times, and you can see that in the show notes where to contact me. I think adaptechsolutions.net is the core place where you can find out more. We have a lot of material as well about event sourcing and CQRS and domain-driven design. There's a blog that's semi-active. We're very busy right now, so we haven't had anything published in the last month, but that's going to change very shortly. So definitely adaptechsolutions.net is the primary place to go.
.net.
.net. Well, we have a .ca as well, and all that other stuff.
And that's to that's to highlight your Microsoft love.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have time for it. Do we have a second podcast?
Right. Unfortunately, I that was another topic I really wanted to get to, and
yeah,
I don't have.
Well, we can quickly go over that. I don't have a lot of love for Microsoft lately with some of the open source shenanigans, but I also understand that they have a tremendous legacy of legal bindings from their legacy from the 80s and 90s, and it's unfortunately the price they pay for their success is all of these things with patents and other things. So I definitely have a love-hate relationship with Microsoft. For us, we're definitely open source only. As I said, our regular stack is all open source. Our standard issue machines are Linux,
So open source was something I really did want to touch upon. Why is open source such an important thing to you? And is Adaptex Solutions regularly contributing upstream to open source projects?
So not in the traditional way, because there's not many open source projects that have an event sourcing sort of way of working, aside from the very frameworks that try to use it, which we're kind of not for frameworks anyway. So it's hard for us. What we do contribute, however, is every 3 weeks generally, is we put a whole project from start to finish that will show you on the Adaptec GitHub page how to build something from the start using the event storming session, then implement it using event sourcing and CKRS, and then deploy it somewhere in the third week, right? So we try to do that. Right now we're working on another system, like I mentioned earlier, Noda. So in terms of a principle that we follow, at least I personally sort of follow, is the idea that open source is the great leveler of making a level playing field for everyone. So you get away from licensing and a lot of obstacles for the betterment of society by doing that. And I have it, in my mind, the importance of open source starts at the very platform. So we always support the platform, the open source platform, number one. And then number two, you go into the frameworks and tools, make sure that they are open source. And then if for a particular business, the total cost of ownership is actually kept down by open sourcing some of the stuff that don't have your core IP and will give away your trade secrets, right? So we find ways to have components that can be open sourced for an organization, because that lowers their total cost of ownership. They can actually share that amongst, for example, if you're, especially in the event sourcing side, if you have a whole bunch of our clients that need to have some component that doesn't have any competitive advantage, but it would be awesome if that was event sourced. Well, we can pool their resources and then give it out to the world. And that's going to be an open source project that then all of these clients take advantage of. But so open source is key on so many levels with how we work, how I work anyway, because I've seen, what the opposite of open source is, and it's not nice. So there's always that sort of fundamental principle in my head of like, if it's open source, I'll take that and pay some price for it initially. But I know in the end it'll win out. It's the eventually everything becomes a commodity, and then if those commodities are allowed to be in the public domain, that's the best for all of us.
Adam Dimitrik of Adaptec Solutions, we'll have to have you on again, but thank you very much for being on the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Thanks, Drew. Very happy to be here.